probably my chosen few that kind of are loyal friends to talk about these things. Today I think what I thought I would do is to cover this particular aspect of caste society and how it actually pans out in the context of diaspora and some of the assumptions that we make in general, how they sort of represent themselves or manifest themselves in the context of so I thought I would take two examples, one from the one that you guys know, Britain, and one from that I know better, South Africa. So I thought I'll begin with the one that you know better, so you can also correct me in case some of my info is wrong. To a certain extent, I depended on Vetterweck's analysis of the British sort of background. I thought I would just clarify a couple of these category sort of confusion. Generally, Asian in the British context has come to mean, in a kind of narrow sense, Indian, but in a little broader sense, it would include Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. But in the context of South Africa, Indian is the term that's used. South Asian or Asian, etc., are not used. The immigration to Britain came mainly from two sets of groups. One from India, that is from the traditional locations of Gujarat, and the other is from East Africa. The one from India, I think at the At the time of the immigration, if you take the partition as the point of departure, it's hard to distinguish whether they were coming from India or from Pakistan, because they were kind of from the same kind of locations and so on. It's only subsequently they kind of identified themselves as either Pakistani or Indian. Perhaps some of them did come after the partition, a little long after the partition, that is, in the 60s and 70s and so on. And then you have the East Africans coming, East African, mainly Gujarati communities that were chucked out of East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Zambia, and Malawi. You know the story about how this happened. The first group that came to Britain, mainly for economic opportunities in the post-colonial Britain, and the later group, as I indicated, came as a result of the whole, what is known as the process of Africanization, now what Mbeki calls African Renaissance. Mainly it affected at that time the East African countries. But I would assume a lot of Zimbabweans should be here now in the last 5-6 years. Indians from Zimbabwe should be here because a whole lot of them left. But I suppose now they have, unlike in the 60s and 70s, they have more destinations to go to, like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and so on. Quite a few left to Canada and Australia. But I think they are also becoming saturated. But I think one advantage to the Indians in these countries is that they all held dual passports. many of them still had their British passports. So that made it easy for them to come to Britain. And of course, yeah.
Well, of course, there was controversy because of the Acts of Parliament that were brought in that then started to narrow that down, and they weren't recognised.
Oh, yeah. But of course, on the other side, Mugabe doesn't want to recognise the British passport, and so he asked them to check them out. So he was on the verge of withdrawing their Zimbabwean passports. According to 91 census mentioned in Bertovec's volume, there were about, by that time, there were about 1.48 million Asians, of which 840 are Indians. That is a total population of 55 million at that time in Britain. 48% of Indians were considered Hindu, 70% of which were Gujarati speaking, of which again 63% from East African Gujarati and 37% are Indian Gujarati. Now these distinctions are interesting. They get very interesting in the social formation, how the Indian society became structured subsequently. 15% of Hindus were Punjabi speaking, of which 20% were East African Punjabis and 80% from India. So which means not many Punjabis actually were in East Africa, which is true because now in Kenya there are only 65,000 Indians, not many Punjabis there at the moment, most of them left. And in my last visit, about 2-3 years ago, 2001, most of them I noticed, they were almost first generation, they were probably about 50% or second, third generation Indians. But there are a lot of first generation Indian merchants, mainly, businessmen coming and so on. According to Agehananda Bharati, interesting, Agehananda Bharati wrote on a number of things. I didn't expect him to write on East African Hindus, but he did. How many of you know Agehananda Bharati? He was an interesting character. He became a sadhu and then sort of gave up. He was more or less a tantric kind of practitioner. And then eventually he went to USA and then gradually gave up his sadhu. And became an academic, and he wrote on virtually everything.
Yeah, he's got a very good autobiography, which charts his journey, but cuts it off probably at his sort of tantric incarnation before him.
I think he does talk about his experience with apparently when he was a sadhu. His most interesting experiences were with women, because apparently women used to, in Indian society, women normally don't, correct me if I'm wrong, don't actually talk to strangers. It's either within a kind of a inside kind of, you know, there is an inner kind of group, like, you know, they talk among themselves, but it's seldom. Let alone with men. But they have very little difficulty talking to sadhus and, religious leaders and so on. And that seems to be very common. And I did notice this also in South Africa. So as a result, he would actually do a lot of counseling. And so he kind of understood women, you know, in those circumstances better. And that society and so on. He writes, you know, sometimes about these things. It sort of influences his writings, actually.
Can you just give his name again?
Bharati Age.
It's
on the notes. Yeah, it's the right on the top left hand there. Age Hananda Bharati.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you say he's originally from Germany?
Hmm.
Yeah, he's a German.
In Germany. Yeah. I don't know which part of Germany, but he was fluent in many Indian languages. I mean, he spoke Sanskrit and all these. Because he literally became like a sadhu, and he went around and he was like a wandering mendicant. So he mentions that though the Gujarati and Punjabis were classed as Hindu, there is hardly anything common between the two of them. Now, this strong spatial separation between Punjabi Hindus and Gujarati Hindus is indicated by the kind of stereotypes that often become common. Punjabis are generally prone to drinking in pubs and meat eating, and they're kind of more sort of outgoing, external kind of people. And Gujaratis are very sort of docile people, very quiet on the quiet side. And they are the opposite of the Punjabis. But I know a lot of Gujarati Baniya people who actually eat meat. And of course they don't eat at home, but they eat outside. So there are all kinds of rules that kind of get broken. Among the Punjabi Hindus, caste distinctions in Britain are less important than regional distinctions, such as the places and so on. But again, I'm not so sure whether we can so radically separate them, because place distinctions are often in line with the caste distinctions, because you often come from a particular village associated with a particular caste. So it's hard to distinguish, but maybe they kind of suppressed it in the context of the broader, you know, British kind of society.
It's interesting too, in the work that Nesbitt has done back in the seems that caste breaks the boundaries of religion. It's more important than, for example, the sequel that Hindu has that asserts that it is.
Yeah. Yeah, for most Hindus, although you can at some level talk about Hindu customs and practices at a kind of broader level, but each caste and each region has its own various kind of differentiated customs and practices, and those are the most important ones. And so we'll talk about how these things play out actually. Towards the end. And caste distinctions are better maintained among the British Gujaratis. Nearly 30 distinct caste groups are identified among the British Gujaratis. And these are linked to status, marriage, social networks, and so on, based on caste affiliations. Within the same caste among the Gujaratis, often social differentiation persisted based on geographical and other considerations. That is, you can find Patels coming from different villages, or Patidars coming from different backgrounds and so on. Mm. I think Patidars are the land-owning people. So they would have, in fact, land-owning people tend to have stronger affinity to their regional geographical customs and practices, because they're very sort of mundane, earthy kind of things. So it's hard to give them up. The distinction between East African Gujarati Hindus and Indian Gujarati Hindus is strongly maintained, even though the East African Gujarati migration has only, it was also post-World War II. In other words, although both migrations have happened after the World War II. So in that sense, those who went to East Africa also went about the same time that the other Gujarati group that came to Britain. So they were about the same kind of culturally and socially, they would be having same kind of practices and so on. But once they went to East Africa and had a second migration back into Britain, they seemed to be treated separately as East Africans. And in fact, they even themselves, East African Gujaratis themselves, would like to be treated as East Africans. In fact, actually what happened, if you look at the whole African sort of context, many Indians that went to African, any of those countries, tried their best to actually become integrated into local politics, local social hierarchies and so on, in that they tried to acquire local citizenship and be treated as, you know, African first and Indian second. And this actually is a debate that goes on. I mean, of course, often these things are questioned for political reasons and so on by the majority population or, you know, anybody else. But they themselves seem to try to remain loyal to those countries where they have gone to and try to sort of make themselves a loyal citizens.
Mm. Can I just ask you something? On this distinction between Indian Gujaratis and East African Gujaratis, do you think there's a class distinction?
Yes.
Because many of them were very wealthy.
Yes.
East Africans,
in fact, Pertovec makes that point. East African Gujaratis came with fairly sort of large sums of capital. So when they came, they could easily sort of open up businesses and, you know, get going. Although, you know, the story that we heard when they left was a pathetic one. That is, it was like, you know, those Idi Amin literally apparently gave them £20 or something and then their clothes and so on. But we know the real story. Many of them pumped out the money long before Idi Amin got to that. So it's the same story with Zimbabwe. A lot of them actually sent money out.
Most of the Kenyans came out earlier
than
they
did. Right. So, but even the ones that are still there, they still have powerful economic control on the Kenyan economy.
Some are now going back.
Now Kenya is actually attracting, even Uganda is attracting, although not many have gone back to Uganda. But a lot of them are returning to Kenya. Kenya is opening up and, you know, there's a strong sort of... but there is also the local politics that affect them. And there is... it's a critical balance, actually, that they somehow feel like they are, you know, sort of trying their best to integrate. And then because they are seen as business people, wealthy and greedy and exploitative. To a large extent, these are stereotypes that are true because some of them do exploit. I mean, they have, certainly Indians in Africa have exploited African labor extensively. In South Africa it was too, and so these stereotypes have some basis, but then they become politically, you know, implicated, and that's when it becomes problematic. In general, among all Hindus, caste or subcaste practices, regional or sectarian variants in traditions, sectarian variants in traditions, contact with revivalist movements and Islam have all been reproduced in Britain in various ways. I don't know if it's going to last, you know, the present generation and the variation of how much that would last, but I think it's something that we need to sort of watch. However, they seem to kind of achieve certain, in certain areas at least, some certain amount of homogenization, some in terms of, for instance, the Hindu calendar, and one of the interesting thing about the neo-Hindu groups is that is where they tend to also homogenize groups where they overcome or ignore their regional ritual practices, customs, and so on. So in other words, it's hard to say how many really, for instance, would be members of, say, Ramakrishna Mission, in the sense that that's the only place they go to. The tendency generally, from my experience, is most Hindus tend to go everywhere. You know, they're kind of members here, members there, and so on. It's just that's been the way Hindu society is always. You know, they don't actually have like a rigid, you know, sort of particular denominational kind of approach to religion. They may have a broader kind of tendency, like you may worship Vishnu or Shiva, things like that, but they may go to any temple. That's, you know, it's no big deal. But I think in places like these, Ramakrishna Mission and, you know, all these neo-Hindu, you know, groups, where actually because they emphasize this broader pan-Hindu kind of philosophy, theology, and so on, there is a tendency to kind of step out of their regional, you know, sort of parochial practices and so on. So, you know, you could go to Brahma Kumaris. I mean, they are talking about Vedanta, basically. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter where you came from and so on, you know. You just fall in line with the broader Vedanta kind of mode of thinking. So these things, and then that actually, the what happens is, once you join these new Hindu groups, there is the other tendency to downplay the ritual aspect. And therefore, the groups that regularly, as members, go to these places, tend to develop this idea that ritual, you know, practices are inferior form of Hinduism, whereas this philosophical Vedanta kind of, you know, approach is more the developed, you know, kind of Hinduism. And that's another thing that happens in South Africa too.
Once people are members of groups like the Brahma Kumaris, they don't move about.
Yes.
Yes, do they? I mean, they tend
to yeah.
And don't have so much to add earlier. I mean, they don't see themselves they don't see themselves as mere Hindus or Hindus.
Yeah.
Because at the 1993 World Parliament of Religions at Chicago, they didn't sign the Global as Hindus. They signed it separately.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting.
Yeah, just on that point, really, would you say that in the diaspora, the change in religious practice in Hindu temples, for example, would you say that because it's in a sense become more congregational, and so you have, you know, Friday and the weekend are important days where people will go, do you think it's encouraging a more kind of like devoted staying with that particular temple? Do you think there's a change in that, that rather than perhaps not being so loyal, which, as you said, is maybe part of traditional approach?
I don't know, but I think
to a particular temple.
Yes, there is also this membership drive by the temple societies, etc., and people tend to go to certain temples because of their leanings, whether, you know, it's a Vaishnava temple or a Shaiva temple, or whether they came from a rural kind of village kind of background where they worshipped, you know, the goddess worship type of people and so on. So it's a combination of their social background, caste background, which seems to appear in the ritual practice. But when they move to these, you know, the pan-Hindu, neo-Hindu kind of organizations, they seem to downplay these, you know, ritual kind of...
It's just you get the sense that it's been such a struggle to establish the temples, you know, financially and spatially, in space and all of that. But certainly the people I've interviewed seem to be very loyal.
Yes.
I mean, others will move around
a bit more, but
there is a real core of...
Majority still actually revolve around temples. Majority Hindus, that's basic. I don't think that will ever disappear. But there is this like select few that become loyal kind of members of, say, ISKCON or Ramakrishna Mission or the Divine Life or the Brahma Kumaris and so on. They tend to kind of somehow think that the ritualized Hinduism based in temples and so on is some kind of inferior form, therefore must be overcome.
What exactly the relation between formation of these neo-Hindu groups and then they downplaying the ritual? What exactly, what's the cause of that?
Well, this was a 19th century phenomenon, actually. You know, the ritual based Hinduism is so diverse. It was so difficult for the then intellectual elite in the context of the British Empire and the Indian Congress, Indian National Congress sort of mass movement, to build up that national kind of sense of being Indian, being Hindu and so on. So if you play on these regional things, there is no way you can unite, you know, create a pan-Hindu kind of awareness. So the intellectual elite in the, up until the time of Gandhi, they were exploring all kinds of, mainly based on Vedanta sources. Tilak was one of them, B.G. Tilak, and Aurobindo was one of them. The Brahma Samaj and Arya Samaj, all of them. Arya Samaj, although he was, Dayananda Saraswati was talking about back to Vedas, if you look at his interpretation of the Vedas, he was Vedanta, actually, that he was bringing in. And you can see that. Of course, he would not admit it, but that's what was happening. So Vedanta, in a way, provided the basis to kind of intellectually create this awareness of being Hindu. But of course, it didn't reach the masses. That's when Gandhi comes in. You know, Gokhale invites at the time Gandhi, because Gokhale was so impressed by Gandhi's strategy of using kind of masses to mobilize masses into political activity in South Africa. And he saw this happening in South Africa, so he quickly invited Gandhi, somewhere in 1800 something, about somewhere around there, about some 15 or so years after Gandhi was in South Africa, he get invited to Calcutta, Indian National Congress Working Committee, to address the executive of the Indian National Congress. And Gandhi spoke as to how important it is to bring masses into the... Because up to that point, it was only Indian elite. The Nehrus and the Patels and, these Gokhales, you know, it was mainly around the intellectuals who were trying to, somehow oppose the British, government. It didn't make any... dent on the British up to that point. So when Gandhi came in, Churchill began to notice. You know, it was a thorn, he was a thorn in his flesh, actually. You know, to the extent that he called him naked fakir and all.
When you say Vedanta, you talk about Advaita.
Well, in a way, Advaita actually was the one that was profiled, not the theistic Vedanta and so on. So because intellectuals like Radhakrishnan and Aurobindo and even Dasgupta, Hiriyana, all of these, Mahadevan, all those intellectuals of that time profiled Advaita as the most, you know, sort of logical thing, you know, logical sort of philosophy. Because Advaita actually had that rigorous logic that withstood the Buddhist logic. So that's the, you know, there was that kind of substantial kind of, and it appealed to the Western, you know, philosophical thinking quite easily. So Western scholars could easily plug into it. Yes, well, the Brahma Samaj and Arya Samaj, you know, they actually arose out of that, you know, this Ram Mohan Roy's quest for monotheistic religion and all of that, actually. Yes, so there was that thing going on. So the Brahmanical, the higher order kind of Hinduism kind of downplayed these things because thinking that this is what appeals to, you know, intellectual people, but then it didn't reach the masses for political reasons. But then at the end of the day, these people wanted political action, and the only way you could do that is to get people moving on the ground and not talk about these things. So Tilak's commentary really didn't make any sense. I mean, big dent in the context of freedom movement, although, you know, he talked about action, you know, as the most important thing, directly drawing from Krishna Arjuna dialogue, you know, how important it is for Indians to now to act, perform their dharma, duty, and all that. That didn't make a big impact, but Gandhi did. The neo-Hindu branches that originated predominantly in India and some in the diaspora have all been reproduced in Britain. So you can see these finding place within the British landscape. The other community, the other minority communities among Hindus in Britain are the Bengalis, the Telugus, Tamils, Indo-Caribbeans, Indo-Mauritians, Indo-Fijians, all of whom have their own ways of worship and practices, and I think they're kind of, there are more and more of them from South India coming, but they still remain on the periphery, really. They don't still have that visibility that the Gujaratis and the Punjabis have. I mean, if you go to South Hall, you only see Punjabis. I mean, every business, every, you know, activity there is kind of Punjabi. Sorry?
If you go to other parts, you'll see Tamil. Like
Tamil. Yeah. I haven't been there, so I must check.
What about Oxford Hindus? Is it Malay Tamil? Tamil? Yeah.
Is there any record of who actually, which community actually first built, went into building of the temples?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of different organizations claim that they were the first.
Would the early temples be more North Indian or South Indian? Or?
Well, the Tamils are later, sort of 10 year decades.
Yeah, really. Obviously they came much later, yes.
Although there were Tamils, of course, in the 50s, education. In Leicester, they reckon the first temple was about 78. It was in somebody's house, and then it became there.
So the corner shop,
that's right. About 78, 79?
A temple in Mahon.
Yeah, so that's quite
less than then they bought a congregation church, which was very well.
The
Wimbledon, South West London, is reckoned to be 1981. And again, that's a chapel that was reconverted.
Yeah. Are these actually built by the Indian sort of sculptors or traditional sculptors, or are they built?
The
they're just
installed.
They're
just
converted that happened to be convenient in size in the Congregationalist chapel in Leicester. They probably now 5 years ago completely redid the inside with their own craftspeople. Earlier than that, again, it had been a very convenient space for use and adaptation, but actually it's now been much more creative.
And sometimes now facades are built onto the outside of the old buildings. But the only buildings built new, according to Shastra, are the Swaminarayan and the big temple in Birmingham, which is the first South Asian temple.
No, there was the one in London, East London, which was built in the 90s. About 91 or something like that.
But the first South Asian built from scratch is going to be open next year in East Ham.
So that would be so.
That's the first in London. There's one in Birmingham.
Yeah. I noticed even in Germany, in Hanover, I saw this Murugan temple, Siva Subramanya temple. It's actually in an old sort of factory building. They rented the space and they built it inside the building. It's rather actually unorthodox, really. You don't build a temple
inside
another building. So there is a roof, and within that there is this thing, you know, which is actually theoretically, according to Hindu, this thing, it's inauspicious, really. You don't actually have something covering the Gopura.
I think that's been done at the Highgate Northern Temple because they weren't allowed, they couldn't get a planning permission. That was an old synagogue that had burnt down. And then they couldn't get the final planning permission. So again, it was built within the established roof.
Yes.
Certainly, New York Coventry, which Ellen has documented right from the burying of all the special objects in the foundation. But it isn't a distinctive, not like this.
I mean, in the olden days, there shouldn't be any other building that is higher than the Gopura of the temple. It's considered kind of inauspicious. In fact, it's bad for the family that builds that high tower building next to the temple. So bad karma. Now, one interesting thing about this caste preservance in the diaspora context is caste is not actually in control of socioeconomic and ritual relations. I think that's the most important or key aspect. It's precisely on that basis social scientists today argue, even in India, caste does not exist. It doesn't mean caste does not exist. I mean, it does exist. I mean, there are, you know, all these castes. But what it means is, in the urban space, in Delhi, Bombay, you know, etc., even in Madras and so on, you see, caste has this, its correlative structures, all based on ritual. Now, it's only in a homogeneous village context or rural small kind of town context you can maintain that, because you see the different caste groups perform different ritual roles in the context of the temple, starting from the Brahmanical groups right down to, you know, the outcasts and so on. And we were the other day talking about this famous debate in the Sri Vaishnava temple context, in South India near Mysore, I think it was in Melkote, it's a small town, little outside Mysore, about 45 minutes drive. A certain caste always performed this ritual procession duties. You know, there's a role that they play, pulling the chariot and so on. And then that caste became Christian in the 19th century. The whole community in that village. So the temple went to court, and they wouldn't pull the chariot and all these because they were the custodians of that ritual, that particular role. So they said, no, we are Christian now, so we can't perform this. It's against our religion and so on. So the temple went to court seeking, interdict on that, and asking court to intervene and force them to perform that ritual obligation. And then, of course, the court eventually decided against the temple because they said, no, they are not Hindus anymore. So they lost caste status by becoming Christian. This has a long, convoluted effect on the Constitution of India, actually, subsequently. So then the temple had to hire some other people. So that's the kind of intrinsic relationship that exists between caste, ritual, and social hierarchy. Now that's absent here in the British context, and even in urban spaces in India, it's the same thing. So people have their caste identities, through marriage and so on. Some maintain that. In urban India, even marriages are becoming problematic when they, are out of their caste boundaries. That's why in the Indian Constitution stipulated that if you became Christian, you lose your caste. That means you don't qualify for, if you're a scheduled caste person, became Christian, you lose your Harijan or scheduled caste status. You don't qualify for these benefits and so on. And that's the reason why Ambedkar went to Buddhism. Yeah, so he didn't want to become a Christian because he couldn't care what religion he was. He wanted to make sure that he maintained, he wanted to make sure that he wouldn't be a Hindu, but he would be considered eligible for, he and his, whoever his followers are, eligible for all the caste-based privileges that the Constitution stipulated.
I thought he considered that Islam and Christianity
he did.
Foreign religions and therefore
yes.
Not appropriate. That was the reason he came up with
his no.
Well, that at least is a religion of India.
No. you see, it's not just there because they are foreign. It's because it's on the basis they are foreign. It's therefore they do not have the caste structure in them. But all the religions that originated in India had the caste structure, and that's why even Parsis have been listed as a caste in the census reports of India. Jains are listed as a caste. They constitute a caste on themselves. So, yeah. So it's kind of interesting.
Because many, because part of the movement is socially engaged Buddhism, would claim that Buddhism doesn't perpetuate.
But it's only true in theory, but actually in reality, both Islam, Christianity, and Buddhism maintained caste.
It's the same in Sri Lanka, where you talk to Buddhists and they're observing castes.
Slightly an aside, but what happens when you've got the socially mobile, moving, socially upward moving?
You mean you acquire a different caste status?
Yes, through your practices, which has gone on and is still going on. Then how are you classed in the census?
Well, you move out of that location. It's only in any case then you are able to change your caste status. When you move to another location, it's like how we say in Telugu, the washerman of this village could be a ready of the other village. Because when he goes to the other village, who knows him? Nobody knows
except
him. So he can...
His name.
No, he changes everything. His identity changes. So he can actually take on a different caste status. It happened in India itself, which is kind of difficult to detect, but I think it happened quite substantially during the Mughal period and the 19th century.
It's gone on a long time.
Yes. And there is a lot of evidence to that. And but in the diaspora, outside India context, it's a substantial change, especially in places like South Africa. Those who went as indentured laborers, you know, they all kind of moved up the ladder. Because we have a serious absence of information about their caste from shiplifts and so on. We don't know much of that information. What we know is their own kind of memory of where they came from, which could be we don't know. That's as best as I could describe.
Change their names.
Yeah. So all you need to do is to add your, you know, ready to next to your name. You know, who is going to stop you from... And then by the second generation, you are Mr. Reddy and so on, Noidu and Governor, or, you know, Padiyachi.
What about to change from Patidar to Patel, because that's quite common here?
In the Gujarati community, that would be quite tricky, because I know in South Africa, the washerman community tried that. But the people, they know who is who. They know who
that's
is who. You see, the guy can go around calling with a different name, but you know, everybody knows who it is, you know, because they are such a close community, and they would, you know, watch out. And so when it comes to marriages, that's when it all pans out, you know, so they wouldn't really have. So they will eventually kind of disappear into other caste groups and so on. Somehow, one thing that I noticed in India is everything that goes into India has to fit in. You know, it creates an identity for itself. In other words, it has to fit into the existing caste structure. If you are not that, then you are given a new name. That's your caste. I don't know if any of you know, there is a caste called Negre. They're actually Negroes or black African people who in the period between 13th and 14th centuries, perhaps even earlier, the Arabs actually took a lot of slaves into India, and these slaves from different parts of Africa, and they employed them in their armies, in the local armies, because they couldn't trust the local Indian, this thing. So they took these slaves and they employed them, and they gave them key positions. There were people from Somalia, Sudan, Malawi, Ethiopia, and you will find them today in Karnataka, for instance, or borders of Maharashtra and so on. There's a study on them, actually. You can find that article.
There's a musical group as well that goes around as the black Indian drummers, and I think they're from Gujarat.
Gujarat also.
They come here.
They're internationally.
Yeah, that whole Western Belt.
Yes.
That's where they actually.
They
ended up eventually there. So they made their kind of. So they are called Negro something.
Mm.
And they speak some kind of mixed local language. Like in the case of Karnataka, they speak a little bit of kind of mixture of Kannada and something else. It could be any of their original vocabularies and so on included. So caste assumption, you know, sort of appropriation of caste statuses and so on does take place, and it's probably relatively easier in the diaspora context, you know, and you acquire ritual status, and wealthy Indians also by sponsoring, you know, patronizing temples and so on, acquire these statuses. Even as early as 10th, 11th century, Ramanuja, I mean reformers, you know, Ramanuja considered himself as a social reformer. He converted a whole lot of hill tribes in that Ghats, Western Ghats area. And he put them as archakas, you know, priests in the temples, in Sri Vaishnava temples, employed them as sort of a lower rung, you know, priests, right at the bottom. Now, surely they must be in that community now. And it's not one or two of them. It's a whole, you see, when a chief converts, a whole tribe converts. So there are substantial numbers of them. So where did they go? So they must have integrated into what are known as the Iyengars today. I don't know. So, but then you see, that's why the Iyengar group is highly stratified. There is an internal hierarchy. So, and they don't interdine, intermarry, and so on. So there is that kind of distinction. Coming to the South African case, as I indicated already, the initial ship lists don't really tell us much about the caste, and subsequent details also, we don't know how much of that information is reliable, because it's, you know, often contradictory between what you see in the paper and what you see in their actual sort of names and, you know, places where they live and so on. The passenger Indians, mainly the Gujarati Hindus and Gujarati Muslims, they came from Gujarat and different parts of Gujarat, and they maintained caste consciousness. They were mainly from Surat and Kathiawad. And they had these regional differences too, Surtis and Kathiawadis and so on. The most of the indentured Indians probably came from any of these fourth class, the so-called Shudra communities, and also from the so-called scheduled caste groups. Many of them have forgotten their caste statuses. But someone who has an insight into that society can actually detect, and you need to do something like, what is it, John Updike's double agent kind of work, you know. You kind of get inside and try to do. Like, there is a, you see, the interesting thing about this caste thing is missionaries in India also operated along caste lines. Because, you see, the social and geographical locations are caste-based. The missionaries didn't want to compete with each other, so the Lutherans went one side, the Baptists went one side, the Methodists went one side, so they kind of, Anglicans went another side and so on, so they did, you know, and Catholics were everywhere. So predominantly, for instance, the British Baptists operated in Andhra Pradesh, for instance, among a particular caste group. The Lutherans and the Church of England, the Anglican, the, was it the Higher Anglican? The old London Missionary Society. What was it?
I'm not sure it's in the Catholic.
Yeah. And they operated among another caste group. Now, I know who these castes are. And then, lo and behold, I found a Telugu Baptist church in South Africa. And this is not the Telugu Baptist church that was established later in more recent times. It was the original. The people who were already Christians belonging to this Baptist church came here and established it. Now, they don't know their caste. They probably forgot. But I could tell where they came from. because I know there couldn't have been any other person who would establish that church unless he was from that caste. You see? And of course nobody would, today of course caste is not a big deal in South African Indian community, so it's not a major thing. So if you tell them it's a piece of news for them, okay, or so what? And they don't even know these ritual, obligations and, whatever. So it's kind of interesting kind of thing. So certainly I think by the second generation they must have acquired all kinds of different caste names and so on, Naidus, Reddys, Padiyachi, and so on. Thanks, Peggy.
Thank you.
Yeah. And most of these names are actually caste sort of affiliations, exist in names, by their last names and so on. If you take a telephone directory, you'll get about 50 to 60 pages of Naidu. Already, full of these in Durban alone. The early associations that were formed in Gujarat, South Africa, among the Gujaratis, they were mainly caste-based. In the South Indian case, the Tamil and Telugu, it didn't happen that way because I think either because they didn't have the requisite numbers to actually call themselves after their caste, or the caste changes that actually already affected their life. But Gujaratis preserved their caste, and I think especially those who came from a fairly respectable caste background tended to preserve that caste. I think that's the key, really. They wanted to sort of maintain that, they were from that caste. There were a few Brahmins as well, but these are mainly from North India. I doubt any, although here and there you get these names, Iyer, appearing. And there are a couple of these names, Nair, etc. But in my sense, these may have been acquired. I doubt in the 19th century any respectable Iyer would have left India. I can guarantee, because it's ritually impure to leave the borders of India. If you're an Orthodox Iyer, they're like Vedic kind of lineage and so on. But who knows? Exceptions could have happened.
Some of them were duped, weren't they? They were deceived into going. It certainly wasn't voluntary.
Yes, there were a few cases where they were kind of misled, and so they were offered like respectable jobs, like clerical jobs and so on in the government positions, which didn't happen when they actually landed. So there was this big advertisement that used to take place in India in those days, apparently. Gold for chilies. Because Indians ate a lot of chilies. Yes. That's the impression, that's another stereotype. So then they advertised, literally, I saw these ads in the, the old documents. So they thought, okay, they could, they said, you can come and grow your chilies and we pay you in gold, so, which didn't happen. So then there was this Quilly Commission, Rags Commission, that tried to investigate the atrocities against the indentured laborers and so on. So the caste-based associations between 1908 and 1934 were mainly the Gujarati associations. And subsequently, the more umbrella type of associations, that is, using the regional names, Kathiawad or Surati, Samaj, and so on. And then more recently, that is certainly after the 60s and 70s, I think, local regional names began to be used. That is Transvaal Gujarati Parishad, Atal Gujarat, Gujarati Parishad, Gujarati Mahila Mandal, very generic kind of name. And the Hindi speaking community also mainly used sort of along linguistic lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have Hindi Siksha Sangh and so on, Veda Dharma Sabha, etc. The arrival of Arya Samaj in 1905 somewhat split the Hindi community into two groups, the Sanatana Dharma Sabha followers and the Arya Samaj. That is, they actually use Sanatanis and Arya Samajis. That's a major distinction between the Hindi groups.
Can you just say a little bit more about this?
Well, the Arya Samaj actually arrived in 1905 to establish the Arya Samaj. Of course, by this time, some important religious leaders were visiting South Africa to preach among Indians, to bring a kind of a Vedanta type of philosophy to, you know, by this time you have this Indian influence. That is, the ritual Hinduism is like somehow inferior.
Yeah.
This Vedanta type of Hinduism is the more superior, accepted kind of thing. So people should give up these rituals. This is actually directly, I think, linked to the Christian, you know, sort of response to ritual Hinduism, idolatry and so on. Now, a couple of Arya Samaj leaders actually arrived. One in 1905, and Swami Premananda, somebody in 1912. They were quite vigorously opposed to Gandhi, and one, I think, was involved in political activity, but then distinguished himself from Gandhi's activities and so on. So they started preaching, of course, mainly among the Hindi-speaking communities, because they were Hindi speakers. And then they started a kind of a reaction to that. The other Hindi groups that are more temple-based groups, you know, they already by this time they have their own temples and so on. So then they started organizing themselves around the other side, that is, calling themselves the Sanatana Dharma, meaning the ritual practices and so on, temple worship, temple-based worship and so on. So that's when this distinction between Sanatana and Arya Samaj becomes very sort of vigorous.
Is
in the
still maintained?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Arya Samaj is quite big now. It is actually mainly driven by the Arya Pratinidhi Sabha, their key organization, and they have a large, well-established Aryan benevolent home, mainly for old people. It's quite an sort of, must be about 100-year-old organization. So they did a lot of social action type of things, social reforms and so on. But they certainly brought in some key competition among these temple-based societies and so on. And then the temples started organizing themselves around these other broader groups to kind of withstand the pressure from Arya Samaj. The Tamil community, of course, didn't suffer from that kind of thing, and they were mainly, to this day, even now, mainly temple-based kind of, rituals and so on. Plus, they have language-associated societies, Tamil Vedic society, Andhra Mahasabha for Telugus and so on. But largely between the Tamils and Telugus, predominantly most Telugus have become sort of integrated into the Tamil community. I think that's probably because of the majority, I mean substantial, I don't have the exact figures as to how many Telugus from coastal Andhra and how many Telugus from the already immigrated once into Tamil Nadu. You know, it's interesting how to now describe diaspora. You see, like if you take the Telugus who have already emigrated into Tamil Nadu, at the time when they emigrated, it was a different country actually, Tamil country, ruled by a different king. Of course, at the time when the immigration or this migration took place, it was a king that had the empire extended right up to the Andhra country, the Vijayanagara Empire, that covered literally 2/3 of the Tamil, I mean the South Indian geography. So at that time there was this migration into Tamil Nadu, about 16th century.
And what was the reason for that?
Well, there was a famine for a number of years. And during that famine, the Vijayanagara Empire began to construct a lot of temples and buildings and, sort of canals, road buildings and so on, in order to generate work to keep the economy running. And that kind of attracted people to migrate. I think incidentally, the Prime Minister of Vijayanagara Empire was a Telugu guy. So he brought in a lot of Telugus. And so that's how in places like Tirunelveli, Trichy, Travancore, you know, all these places, Tanjore, a lot of Telugus, Reddys and Naidus and so on. So they, for practical purposes, they spoke the Tamil and they appropriated Tamil culture and so on, and Paratasi and all these festivals they all performed. So when they re-immigrated or, you know, migrated into South Africa, so they came from there. So their culture is pretty much Tamilized, as you know already. And then you also have these Telugus from coastal Andhra, you know, Krishna, Godavari districts, these deltas. And they retained some Telugu consciousness. And in fact, they also lived in separate locations. If you come to Durban, you will see these, you know, the Andhra locations. And so on. So they established what is now called Andhra Mahasabha. So it's mainly the Telugus who spoke Telugu, you know, sort of performed their cultural and social practices. And so so they actually, I said this one time before, they even spell their name Naidu differently. N-A-I-D-O-O, meaning Tamil. N-A-I-D-U, meaning Telugu. Telugu Naidus and Tamil Naidu. So you get both of them. And, but then caste virtually disappeared among the Hindi-speaking and Tamil-speaking, I mean the South Indian-speaking community. So the marriages were either within the Hindi-speaking or within the South Indian. Telugu Tamils intermarried quite openly.
So more language-based, really.
Yeah. But in the case of South Indian, you know, it just kind of disappeared very quickly. Telugus and Tamils intermarried quite freely. And, I mean, there were some broad considerations. It's like as long as you're a Naidu, Reddy, etc., you could marry a Padiyachi, a Govinda, or a, you know, one of these Tamil kind of. So they knew kind of among themselves who kind of you know, had a cognate sort of same social status. My hunch is some of the lower caste Hindus eventually converted to Christianity. So you will find these conversions that took place in the Brake village. It's called Brake village, along the railway lines and so on.
Break,
and the
Brake,
B-R-A-K-E.
Yeah.
Brake village. And then the old, you know, in them days they built what is called like a box type kind of houses for them.
Mm.
And what was it called? So it's kind of barracks.
Mm.
Barracks. So, so if you say you are from the barracks,
mm.
they also knew the caste. If not the exact caste, but the
mm.
level.
The level of it,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So predominantly conversions happened there.
Mm.
They went into Christianity.
Mm.
And I would imagine it was an attempt also there also to kind of escape from the caste,
yeah. Yeah.
Hindus and so on. You can see those today appearing in Phoenix and you know, some of the Chatsworth interior Chatsworth
yeah.
locations and so on.
But these intermarriages wouldn't happen presumably in Karnataka or, you know, the bilingual speakers, the Tamil Telugu
mm.
communities, that wouldn't, that kind of fusion integration wouldn't happen actually in India.
No,
it,
no, not so easy unless no. it's kind of different, you know,
mm.
definitely not through an arranged marriage.
No, no.
It has to be other considerations, either love marriage or, you know, other considerations.
Although they've migrated, they still in fact keep as a separate
mm.
community within Tamil.
Yes,
mm.
yeah.
yeah.
And it is, in that sense, in the Indian urban space, marriages still take place within caste groups.
Mm.
Mm.
Basically, they go back to their state and
mm.
find an appropriate girl or a boy and so on. But Gujaratis actually went far beyond the seas to find their brides and bridegrooms. I don't know how many of you saw this in the somewhere in the 70s it was produced. A Girl from India. It was based on Gujarati community in the UK. It's based on a Gujarati family. I mean, it's a rather kind of interesting, I mean, well, it's a story that actually reveals the manner in which Gujarati community here
mm.
held on to their religious mm. and cultural values and so on. And then what happens to younger generation
mm.
as a result of that, you know,
mm.
the repercussions, the personal lives,
mm.
etc. and so on. So this girl actually comes from Gujarat, and she's from Bombay, actually. She's a Gujarati, but she's from Bombay. And she's as westernized as anybody else, actually.
Mm.
And they thought, okay, we are going for this traditional girl.
Traditional.
Maybe
yeah.
she was all dressed
right.
up like a traditional girl on the day of that arrangement when they went to visit. And then later she turns out to be a very highly westernized girl. And then this guy who married her is actually raised as a very, very strong orthodox
mm.
guy.
In the diaspora.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then one of the values that was imparted to him by his father, by his parents, was any woman that you see is your mother, Mataji. You know,
mm.
she's your mother. So he actually has a psychological problem now. Now, on the day of their nuptial,
mm.
This
mm.
thing, the guy, you know, couldn't actually do anything because she's the mother.
Mm.
How can he have sex with the mother?
Mm.
So that became a problem. So then the marriage kind of starts to break down, and so the family doesn't know what's going on, and then he actually, but at the same time he's a very, very liberal westernized kind of mindset, he actually tells his wife, look, there's no way you and I can have any happiness. Please go and find your happiness anywhere else. He openly tells her. And then, of course, Kabir Bedi appears, and, so she romanticizes with him, and then there was an unfortunate incident in a bar when this boy was killed in the bar. You know, there was a fight. He wasn't actually involved in the fight, he was in the middle of it, and then somebody stabs him, and then he dies. Then, by this time, of course, the story is out. I mean, the parents knew what was going on, and the father actually chucks her out, I mean, the father-in-law. And she was even prevented from even getting nearer the dead body. So she was, like, ostracized and everything else. And all that.
This is a film?
Film.
Of a true story? From
well, I suppose it is kind of... I think it appeared in the 70s. I saw it long time ago, A Girl from India.
Mm.
It was very well done, though. It was all British.
Where did you see it?
I saw it in America, actually, in the 80s, but it was filmed, I mean, it was made in the 70s. In 86, I think I saw it. I'm sure it must be, some copy must be somewhere. But it was very beautifully done. The story was really gripping, and you can see the emotions running high, and as the story unfolded, and the parents trying to hold on to these traditions, and the whole family breaking down, and the East-Western kind of value systems kind of interaction, all of that. Anyway, let me stop there and...
Can I just ask you one thing about the passenger immigrants?
Yeah.
So, they were coming still for work, but not as indentured?
No, they came as businessmen.
Right.
You see, by this time, this is now 1875,
yeah.
Around there,
yeah.
The first batches of passenger Indians started coming. By this time, by one decade or so, there are a few thousands of Indians already.
Yeah.
So then the Gujarati merchants, you see, they were already in other parts of Africa. So they were moving in.
Oh,
and some directly from Gujarat and so on to trade. So they were bringing the trade, you know.
But the Gujarati history in East Africa still also has indentured workers, doesn't it?
Not as many.
But there's still...
Ugandan Railway.
They came to the railways, yeah.
Yes.
And South Africa also had slaves brought in from...
Mm-hmm.
Initially from China. The earliest slaves were way back in 1670, Peter Teeth actually married a Bengali woman, and her name was, must have been Anjali or something, and she became Angela.
Yeah.
She is documented as Angela
in
the documents.
Yeah.
She must have been Anjali or something. We knew she was a Bengali, and there's enough evidence to that. And he brought her as a slave, and then he married her. And of course, then his family left him. So she literally took care of him till the end of his life.
Just one more point on this business of caste, as you say about the Gujaratis. One of my Gujarati friends talk about, say, when we talked about Navratri last week, and they talk about going to their village associations for Navratri, and they've come out of East Africa, they've been there 25, 30 years, and they're still saying it's our village association.
Yeah. And for many East African Gujaratis, going to East Africa is sometimes more important to them than going to India.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So this is when we were talking about diaspora a couple of weeks ago, that homeland, in fact.
their home. They think
yeah.
of homeland as home as like this.
Yeah.
yeah.
In fact, another group I was with last week as well, they've just come back from 3 weeks in Kenya. They still have the family house.
Yeah.
And their family has sponsored the building of a temple, which
That's a beautiful temple, that one, they built. They have a museum inside. Can you believe that? They have recreated fascinating museum and all kinds of things. It's it's a work of in its on its own, really. And yeah, there's a big.
There's quite an ambivalence also, isn't there? When people go back to India who haven't been back and they trace their roots, sometimes the shock of it, or because they've.
Or they feel outside.
Because of their class, as you were saying, it's quite different.
Yeah.
And they've cut their roots, as it were.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different.
To me
because they've got to be in caste, as you say, because there is no caste operating where they live.
Yeah.
In fact, their feelings towards the homeland is quite.